This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we take a closer look at the scope of terrorism. Glenn Schweitzer of the National Academy of Sciences is our guest this afternoon. He's co-author of the book, A Faceless Enemy, The Origins of Modern Terrorism. His co-author, Carol Dortch Schweitzer. First published in 1998, the book predicted large-scale attacks on the U.S. and explained the threat presented by biological agents, including anthrax. It also explored the threats posed by nuclear and chemical weapons in the hands of terrorists, and it highlighted the connections between terrorists and organized crime. A Faceless Enemy has been republished with a new prologue, the new edition published by Perseus Publishing. Glenn Schweitzer is Director of Central European and Eurasian Affairs at the National Academy of Sciences, the first director of the International Science and Technology Center in Moscow. He's worked to secure and reduce weaponry left over from the Cold War. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Glenn Schweitzer, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you, Celeste. I'm glad to be with you.
Your book was first published in 1998, as I mentioned. What kind of attention did it receive at the time?
At the time, it did not receive a great deal of attention, in terms of number of copies sold. I did write some shorter articles, which were much more widely read. I think at the time, people were more interested in just a very quick look at terrorism than digging into a book. But, of course, when after September 11th, the remaining books were immediately sold out.
Yeah. And I would imagine now that it's been republished, the book is receiving a new round of attention and perhaps more attention than it received in 1998.
Oh, I think so, yes. I think the whole topic has escalated in terms of the interest of the American public because it's up close and personal right now.
Yeah. In this book that you wrote in 1998, you list several warnings that there would be a major strike against the U.S. In the U.S., including the World Trade Center bombing in 1993, foiled attempts at bringing down planes over the Pacific in 94, the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Africa, and the attack on the USS Cole. Did our government fail to learn from those events or fail to apply the lessons learned?
Well, I think there is the extent to which they applied the lessons learned. There's no question that President Clinton was very active in this area and starting in about 1995 really increased the vigilance in the United States to the problem of terrorism, although I think all of us underestimated the growth of terrorism around the world and the power that the terrorists could really bring to the United States. Back in 1998, I was very concerned there would be hits on the United States, but I did not imagine as devastating as what happened on September 11th.
Yeah. Our attention has been greatest on the threat posed now by al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Are there other forces we should be aware of and concerned about?
Yes, there are a whole host of other groups that are loosely affiliated with these kinds of movements in the Middle East, of course, which is where the current attention is. But in the longer run, I think we have to be concerned about a discontent people in all parts of the world, which for one reason or another are tempted to take aim at the United States. So while in the next couple of years, I'm sure our attention will be riveted on the Middle East, and there are 25 or 30 such organizations operating there, none on the scale of al-Qaeda, but in time, I think that we will have also unfortunate incidents which have their roots in other continents of the world.
Mm. It's almost been 1 year now since the attacks of September 11th, almost daily we read articles telling us that we're unprepared for further attacks. What's your assessment of the progress or lack of progress we've made in the past year in terms of preparing for further attacks?
Oh, I think it's been enormous. I think the amount of attention given to this topic, particularly at the federal level, but also at the local levels, has been amazing. I think that's because the blow in New York was so devastating. Had it been a smaller hit in New York, I don't think they would have gotten our attention like they've gotten our attention now. So I think all across America, people are aware of this, not only in the airports and the sports stadiums and the museums and whatever, in Carnegie Hall and wherever, but terrorism is on the front burner. Now, the question is, how long can we sustain that, and how long will we have to sustain this heightened sense of vigilance? If there is not another instance soon, will people relax again and say, well, we survived, and now we're equipped, ready to go forward? And if we do keep our guard up, just how long do we have to keep our guard up?
Mm. What's your thinking about the new security precautions being taken at airports?
Well, I think all of us are a pretty good critic. We all like to criticize. I think one of the problems has been getting more highly qualified personnel in place, and there are a few airports that have succeeded in that regard. I think Baltimore, Washington is a good case in point, where the security personnel are now at a much higher level than they were a few months ago. The procedures for a passenger screening seem to be quite extensive. Anyone who's flown through the United States in recent months is aware of that. Of course, the bombing and the shooting in Los Angeles raised concerns about where people gather before they go through the security barriers. The two biggest concerns, I think, on the airlines, one is the private planes, which keep flying with relatively little regulation, and the cargo planes, which have offered a challenge in themselves. But overall, the airlines have been very highly sensitized to the problems, and I think the problem now is to make sure we keep our air passengers moving, but still they're moving in a safe way.
Those security threats posed, or potential security threats posed by private planes and cargo planes, can they be addressed? Are there things we could do to address the potential for problems there?
I think on the small planes, I think there are a lot of private pilots who are fully trustworthy and are obviously not eager to subject themselves to more constraints. But I think there has to be a greater degree of regulation. A lot of the regulation of the small aircrafts now is on the basis of guidelines rather than regulations. Mm-hmm. And I regret, but I think we have to have some pretty tight handles on small aircraft into the future. On the cargo planes, there the problem is how does one inspect these huge containers? They aren't nearly the size as the containers coming off ships, but nevertheless they are significant. And there, I think, very gradually things are tightening up, but I think we still have ways to go on that.
Yeah. Yesterday, copies of a report on the unreadiness of the EPA began to circulate. And I think that reports of this report are in the papers today. This was a report completed last winter, and among other things, it notes that the agency has limited authority to require action in situations that present some vulnerability. Is this a problem? You know, you mentioned recommendations instead of regulations. Is that in general a problem, that there is limited authority to require action that regulation is lacking?
Well, I spent a number of years in EPA responsible for the toxic chemical program, and so I am somewhat familiar with what EPA can and can't do. And I think it's a little bit of an unfair rap on EPA, because they were never set up as a terrorism cleanup agency. They were set up to put in place environmental regulations and to make sure that those regulations are met. So when they were challenged here in Washington with the cleaning up of one of the congressional buildings, that is a whole new dimension of their activities, and they aren't staffed for that. They have no experience in that, and so it's very difficult. So I think there's a real concern now. What is the appropriate role for EPA? Should EPA really be the terrorism cleanup overseer, or is that really not an appropriate role for EPA? And if EPA is to do that, does that mean a big enlargement of the bureaucracy and so forth? So, well, I saw the article too, and I was concerned about this criticism. It was written internally, so it's self-criticism, which is, I guess, is always a healthy thing for the government to do. But I'm not sure EPA is going to be a decisive force in the struggle with terrorism.
Mm. Do you think that we'll see a reassessment of roles of a number of government agencies over time as we continue to look at the problem?
Yes, well, that's going on right now. As you undoubtedly know, there is the proposal to establish a new Department of Homeland Security, mm-hmm. which would fold in something like 30 different organizational units from agencies and from a variety of departments and agencies. And I suspect by the end of the year there will be a new Department of Homeland Security in some shape. It may not look exactly like the president has proposed, but it will undoubtedly be in place, I think, is the reading of the tea leaves here. Now, there the question is, can we have a Homeland Security agency that doesn't become a department of oppression of citizenry? And so that's going to be a very difficult job for that particular new department. But I think it's in the cards, it's going to happen, and I think now we all need to try our best to influence it in a sensible course that really genuinely protects us, but at the same time doesn't, get into our pockets.
Yeah. What do you think the role of a sensible Department of Homeland Security would be? What would be, you know, what would be its role?
Well, I think that this whole issue of counterterrorism is a responsibility of the whole country. If you're going to protect the power lines or the water systems or the gas lines, that's all private sector. That's not government. So somehow the whole private sector, the local governments have to be galvanized to be more vigilant on their own and then work together. So I think one of the big responsibilities of the new department is to provide leadership in encouraging this kind of galvanization throughout the country, make an information flow to make sure that the various organizations with concerns over security, over facilities, have access to information that is available, that they have a chance to express their concerns up the line. There's a sympathetic voice in Washington that listens to the concerns of the people who feel threatened. And now this is a very intangible task, but I think it's terribly important. Of course, there will be functions like controlling the borders and immigration regulations and so forth. But I think the concept that the department should be a catalyzer and a sister of local initiatives and local problems, I think is key, and not just a dictatorial department that says here's how you're going to do it in Urbana or Los Angeles or wherever.
Hmm. Have we made progress when it comes to addressing the causes of terrorism?
Well, that, in my view, is the neglected area. Not only understanding what the causes are, but doing something about them. And so right now we're trying to do something about the bin Laden and his people because of their immediate impact on us. And we're pretty good in running down the renegades and bringing them to justice, and that takes care of the problem for a few months or a few years, but that doesn't really get to the root causes of terrorism, and I think this is the area where we really have to change course. The United States is so powerful now that around the world there's a feeling of almost second-class citizenry, and somehow we have to help our friends and maybe adversaries understand that we're going to live together and we're not there to exploit them. And so this whole issue of root causes of terrorism and what can be done about it, I think, is very important if my grandchildren are to have stable lives in the years ahead.
Mm. In terms of addressing the causes of terrorism, what do you think our priorities should be?
Well, I think there are several key things. One is, I think the rhetoric is very important. I think we have to, when leaders of the country speak, they ought to have to worry about what they're saying, because people listen, newspapers pick it up, and if we're not careful, there'll be a boomerang effect in the years ahead. For example, we trumpet the wonders of globalization, and the multinational companies are all over the world. Communications now hits everyone, and so forth. But a lot of people view globalization as meaning Americanization, and so we have to be careful when we talk about this latest this globalization. We have to be. We are often perceived as the country that wants the status quo for everybody else while we zoom ahead. And then, of course, there the whole issue of poverty. Poverty has something to do with terrorism. Now, it may not be a direct cause of the incidents we see on a day-to-day basis, but over time, I think poverty, unemployment, and frustrations are a major cause. So on the root causes, my priority number one would be a combination of carefully chosen words on our part when we go public, plus a major support for education and job creation around the world.
Hmm. Prevention and preemption is an area you've worked in for some time. You note in the book's new prologue that on September 11th, you were attending a seminar on developing new income streams for the closed atomic cities of Russia. Would you talk with us about that effort and why it's important?
Well, yes. When the Soviet Union fell apart about 10 years ago, there was economic chaos because of the difficulties of making a transition from communism to free market economies, which was being attempted. And as the economy fell apart, the income levels for Russians in general went down. Of course, a few got rich, but most of the people really were hit hard in terms of their income levels going down. Now, as everyone knows, the Soviet Union had millions of people involved in a military effort using highly sophisticated technology targeted primarily at us. And the concern was that these large numbers of people with rare technical skills, whether they be nuclear or biological or whatever, would in their economic desperation seek out buyers of their expertise from countries that we don't consider that aren't too friendly and have hostile intentions. And so the concern has been that unemployed or underemployed weaponeers in Russia would seek to supplement their incomes by selling their expertise on weaponry to forces around the world. So the particular effort I was involved in on September 11th was to try to help Russian colleagues understand how the free market works, and specifically how it might work in the closed nuclear cities of Russia, where much of the scientific expertise is concentrated, and to try to see if we couldn't develop joint programs that would provide opportunities for them to redirect their weapons talent to civilian endeavors rather than trying to sell their weapons talent. Mm-hmm. And that was the project that was involved in September 11th. And it's a difficult problem because the Russians have been isolated. These towns that we were addressing, maybe 50,000, 100,000 people, are isolated in Siberia and the Urals and so forth. And for those people to seek an income in the civilian sector out there is not easy.
These efforts, have they borne fruit yet?
I think there are a few success stories and lots of frustrations. There have been a few success stories where either a Western company was enticed to invest and work with the local Russians to use their talent, so both sides benefit. For example, Intel has set up computer centers in one or two of these distant towns where Russian computer programmers who are highly skilled work together with Intel to develop software products that are marketed around the world. But there have been, for every success, there have been, I would say, dozens of failures where the Russian technology just didn't mesh with the demands of the market, or by the time it got to market, they were already behind the Asian countries or the West European countries and so forth. So it's a very tough problem. It's probably the toughest problem that exists in Russia, but nevertheless, I think we have to keep chipping away at it.
Hmm. Do you think we're committed to that, working on that problem?
Well, yes and no. When the problem is cast in terms of that they're likely to, this weapons technology is likely to spread and hit us in the back, I think people pay attention. They understand and they say yes, that's a good project to those are good programs to support. And now, thanks to former Senator Nunn and Senator Lugar, there are substantial programs in place to work with the Russians to prevent this kind of proliferation, which is not only in their interest, but in our interest, too. On the other hand, when these programs are portrayed as assistance programs, then a lot of people will say, well, why are we giving assistance to former weapons people in Russia? So they see it simply as our taxpayers' money going there, and what, does that really make sense when we have some problems of our own at home and so forth? So usually the people who see the big picture prevail in these debates, and we have, as of right now, sizable programs that are doing a really important, playing important roles in containing the threat of weapons proliferation from Russia.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Glenn Schweitzer is our guest this afternoon. He's director of Central European and Eurasian Affairs at the National Academy of Sciences, the first director of the International Science and Technology Center in Moscow. He's worked to secure and reduce weaponry left over from the Cold War. He and Carol Dorch Schweitzer are the authors of A Faceless Enemy, The Origins of Modern Terrorism. The book was first published in 1998. It has been republished with a new prologue by Perseus Publishing. If you'd like to talk with our guest, Glenn Schweitzer, give us a call this afternoon. Questions and comments are welcome. Here are the phone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. In this book, A Faceless Enemy, you wrote back in 1998 about an incident reported in 1994 about the lack of security at Russian nuclear facilities. There is a report in here that is quite disturbing, one thing among many disturbing things that you report on in the book. This involves a Russian repository for nuclear fuel, and you quote an investigator commenting on the situation, who said at the time, potatoes are guarded better. What's the situation today?
I think the situation is much improved today. There still are some worries, but at that time, the economy in Russia had hit an all-time low. There was a scramble among the security personnel for finding new jobs elsewhere, and as I noted, there was nobody home guarding the nuclear materials that might be used in weaponry. And we did indeed visit a number of facilities where the guards could not afford to buy overcoats and did not have overcoats, and so in the cold weather they didn't go out to their guard posts, which are outside. But that was about 7 or 8 years ago, and I think in the last few years the economy has slowly recovered. The security services in Russia, for better or for worse, have again gotten their act together and are much more vigilant now. And this is, I think, good around nuclear facilities. You worry about it some; they don't go too far in the cities. But in nuclear facilities, it's important, I think, that the guard force be well disciplined and alert. And so I don't think there's as nearly as much of a problem now as there was then. Of course, the issue is, In that early period, in the early 1990s, were there opportunities for the theft of nuclear material, and was nuclear material taken, and is it somehow being stashed in places for later use? Nobody knows that. There is no real evidence that it is, but I think that's a real worry, because for those of us who had the opportunity back in the early 90s to walk through these facilities, to consult with the people, to talk about what the problems were, I think we have a little bit of an uneasiness that maybe there were some people with cash in the pocket visiting these places, and some of it may have gotten out.
Hmm. Have the accounting systems for nuclear material improved?
Yes, but again, it's the same problem. What was the starting point? And in the old Soviet Union, the accounting systems were not Western style accounting systems. The managers of institutions always held back some material, whether it be nuclear material or whether it be automobiles or whatever, and then they would use this reserve to make sure they met their quotas, because they were paid on a quota basis every year, and they needed a reserve to be sure that if on a bad year they wouldn't be penalized for not meeting their quota. So the accounting systems were very elastic. And now, but then in the 90s, when the new Russia started getting its act together more in a Western orientation, with less concern over meeting Soviet-style production goals, and the attempts were made to install accounting systems that were reliable and accurate, the first problem was, what is the baseline? Do the institutions even know what they have at the time, or was some siphoned off and stored somewhere else? Leaving that problem aside, I think it's fair to say that the accounting systems have come a long way in the last 6 or 8 years. And the United States specialists, again, under the Nunn-Lugar program and daughter programs, have played a very important role in making this happen.
Well, how reliable are our accounting systems for this kind of material in this country?
Well, the U.S. government will say they're reliable enough to make sure that we know where everything is. But if the critics will then go into the details, and they'll find that a very small diversion here or there, whether it be a mathematical problem or whether it be an actual problem of weighing the material or whatever, if there are enough of those discrepancies, they can add up, and then indeed you don't have an exact balance. Now, we argue, and I think our arguments are correct, that while we don't have a precise balance on the books of every institution, the discrepancies are really due to measurement errors and not due to the fact that somebody stole something.
Hmm. If you were to develop a list of threats to our national security in the area of terrorism, what would be at the top of the list?
Well, I think that this somewhat reflects my background, of course. I am very concerned about chemical plants. There was a very nasty disaster in India a few years ago, where there was an accident in a Union Carbide plant in India, which resulted in 20,000 deaths because the plant was located in an urban area. And we have a number of chemical plants in urban areas of the United States. The chemical industry is very good. In my experience, the chemical industry has been very good, first in the environmental protection area, now I'm sure in the accident area, and now I'm sure in the terrorism area. But nevertheless, we have an awful lot of vulnerable targets out there in the area of chemicals. And so I can only hope that we've really tightened up the industrial security at these facilities, and they will be battened down pretty well.
Mm.
A second area, which is, I don't know, it's one of the very poorly understood areas, is the cyber-terrorism area. And I think this is a work in progress. I think all of the time some terrorists out there somewhere, maybe one or two people in a remote village, or maybe a cluster of people in a big city, are probing our computer systems that govern our power line, our power systems, our energy systems, our airline systems, our financial systems, and whatever. And it's sort of like a cat and dog activity all the time. They're constantly trying to make breakthroughs, and then we have our defenses up. And I think anyone who is active on the computer knows about the viruses that are that are always coming in, and the latest program to keep them out, well, it's more serious than viruses. It's actually worry about the computer hackers, not the very sophisticated computer hackers, being able to get into serious systems like, again, like electrical power systems. So I think that's a second concern. And then another concern I have, of course, at the border are all these container ships coming in, and anyone who's driven through Long Beach, California, up the New Jersey coast, sees these acres and acres of huge containers full of no one exactly knows what. Many years we were worried about drugs coming in that way, but now their worry is that more dangerous materials will come in than that, and so I think that's a third concern.
Hmm. So chemicals, cyber terrorism, and transportation.
Containers.
Yeah. It goes back to, also, we're talking about cargo planes and private planes, and we still are worried about airport security given the shooting on the 4th of July at the El Al ticket counter at Los Angeles.
Yeah, the problem, I think, I don't know of anyone who really predicted turning an airplane into a missile, like was done on September 11th. I think several people have written that they did write about that years ago. But in general, I think that caught everyone by surprise. And so that what it did point out is the terrorists are very smart in terms of finding the weak spots. And I think in the next 5 or 10 or 15 years, we're going to have to continually have this battle of can we harden the weak spots before they find them, and then hopefully in time we will have effective ways to start to win over the hearts and minds of people who have decided to go in different directions. We have to really win the hearts and minds of the children, because I'm afraid many of these adult terrorists are we're going to have a hard time convincing them to change course. But if we can somehow work with colleagues around the world and improve the prospects for the children, I think then we will have a chance of bringing this somewhat to an end.
As you mentioned, you couldn't have predicted that airplanes would be used as missiles. But in the book, A Faceless Enemy, back in 1998, you were worried about security in harbors and ships being used as missiles.
And there's still a worry about that, yes. There are these liquefied natural gas ships that come into Houston and other places, which, if they are detonated, that's a mini atomic bomb going off. So, but again, I think the terrorists have our attention. I think that those ships now are in under closer scrutiny than they were, but nevertheless, there are problems in our harbors as all sorts of cargo, dangerous cargo, comes into our harbors.
Hmm. You also wrote in 1998 about biological agents.
Yes.
And this has come to pass. Anthrax attacks began last September, after September 11th. What's the situation here? We've also heard about, you know, the concerns we have about smallpox. There are only a couple of remaining strains of the virus. How secure are they, and how big a risk, how significant a risk do you think smallpox is?
Well, let me take just a minute on anthrax. I think anthrax is a very old story, and back about 8 or 10 years ago, all the discussion of biological warfare biological terrorism was that the terrorists would somehow invent new super strains of Ebola or whatever, which would then do us all in. But in fact, back I was in the group that thought that the terrorists would keep it simple, and we had some experience in looking at the Iraqi efforts in biological warfare, and one of the simple agents is anthrax, which is a naturally occurring a microbe in the agricultural arena. So back when I wrote the book a few years ago, there were a lot of false alarms of people sending powder in envelopes and writing on it anthrax. There were several incidents here in Washington. There were incidents in other parts of the country. And so anthrax seemed to me and seemed to a lot of people to be the obvious choice because it was readily available and so forth. And so that's what came to pass. Unfortunately, the perpetrator hasn't been located yet. With regard to smallpox, there's a difference between smallpox and anthrax. Anthrax, in order to get the disease, you have to actually come in contact with the anthrax spores. It's not contagious. You can't be infected from person to person to person, whereas in smallpox, if one person is infected, then that person is a time bomb walking around infecting lots of other people. And so the real worry is that there would be a smallpox infection that which would then multiply very rapidly and would hit conceivably hundreds of thousands or millions of people as these walking time bombs circulated throughout the urban areas. There are two places in the world where smallpox is currently stored. Smallpox as a disease was pronounced eradicated about 15 or 20 years ago, and the world community decided, let's get rid of all the smallpox strains, except let's save a few for research purposes and keep some in Atlanta and some in Novosibirsk, Siberia. And so we have two repositories, one in Siberia and one in Atlanta, Georgia, where there are some smallpox strains which are kept under lock and key, and hopefully under high security, which are used from time to time in terms of doing research on related strains or in developing vaccines should smallpox again reappear. Now, we're hopeful that there aren't countries who kept smallpox stocks clandestinely back a decade or more ago when it was decided to destroy all the supplies. We are hopeful that all the countries of the world abided by this agreement and got rid of their smallpox strains, and they only exist in two places, namely Siberia and Atlanta. But if it gets out, then it's a real problem because it's contagious from person to person.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the anthrax is, you have to be exposed directly to the spores.
Do you think Iraq, a nation like Iraq, could be holding smallpox?
Well, they've according to the inspectors who went in there 4 or 5 years ago, they were experimenting with something called camelpox, which is a related agent, and apparently it will also cause diseases, but that is still somewhat speculative. So my best guess is that if we worry about biological agents in Iraq, we'd be better off to think about anthrax than about smallpox.
Hmm. Other things about Iraq that concern you?
Well, of course, right now Iraq is the big discussion item here in the East Coast, and I think we're all concerned that Iraq will continue to go forward and build up its biological weaponry, its missile capability, and its chemical capability, and perhaps even its nuclear. On the other hand, it's a tough issue what to do about it, and I'm not sure I agree with the notion that, well, we ought to go in and just take out the leadership and destroy all of their capabilities. I don't know if we could ever find their capabilities. We certainly couldn't destroy the people. The people have a lot of capabilities in their heads. So, sure, Iraq is a real problem, but the solution is not obvious.
Hmm. What do you think of the embargo against Iraq?
Well, the that's taken a number of forms. Of course, it's weakened by the fact that the Europeans are not as enthusiastic and as we are about the embargo. And then there seems to be some leaks in the system where the oil is sold allegedly for humanitarian purposes, but somehow machinery finds its way in. I think it's probably the only device we have short of invasion right now. And so I think it's probably a good idea. I would worry if we took the embargo off, the buildup of military capability there would be real very quickly, And that would be another flashpoint that would be very dangerous indeed.
Hmm. I wonder if you have been troubled at all by steps we have taken in order to retaliate against rogue states or terrorist groups, that they're it could backfire.
Well, what I worry about is when the Congress gives $35 billion to fight the war in Afghanistan and gives $22 billion to fight the war in Kosovo and so forth, they don't give any money to rebuild. And so now we are the black hats that go around destroying everybody, and we say, okay, other people like the Europeans can rebuild them. So the Europeans take their funds and they rebuild Kosovo, and they become the white hats where the Americans, we knocked out the power plants, they're going to rebuild them, and I'm not sure that's good for our image. And the same thing is happening now in Afghanistan. And my concern is that when Congress makes an appropriation for a supplemental military budget, they should designate 20% of that or some percent of that should be for rebuilding the country and not just for destroying the country. And so I think that is my greatest concern, that we are viewed as a pretty strong military power for short-term purposes, but this is very problematical as stopping terrorism over time. And I don't think we have any choice but to retaliate with force when we're hit like we were in New York City and here in Washington. But I think we have to have a longer perspective than that.
Hmm. What are your thoughts about what constitutes terrorism? Some people in the world would accuse the United States of state terrorism. What constitutes terrorism in your mind?
Well, there are something like 200 definitions of terrorism, and it depends on the where you sit. I think the U.S. government adopted a definition of terrorism after the Munich Olympics back a few years ago when there were the murder of the Israeli athletes. Which and the particular special ingredients was, or the characteristics were, one, it had to be targeted on sort of innocent people. Innocent people were the victims, and two, there was a political rationale for it, either to make a political statement or to seek a redress for political grievances or whatever. But so it was really considered a political act. But that, I think, has become very blurred in recent years. It's now all wrapped up with religious fanaticism. It's wrapped up with economic greed, and it's very difficult sometimes to tell whether terrorism is terrorism. Let's take the shooting in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
The Israelis immediately identified this person as a suicide bomber, and so suicide bombers are obviously terrorists. So they say he's a terrorist. The Los Angeles police say, no, it was just a street crime. Some guy was, for whatever reason, went off the deep end and went around and shot people, and that's street crime. I think the point isn't whether it's terrorism or not terrorism. I think murder is murder is murder and has to be treated that way. But that's easy to say that, but then when you talk about the roots of it, then you have a different kind of concern. So, and finally, I think, everyone talks about when is it a terrorist or a freedom fighter. And Kashmir, for example, mm-hmm. is a good example. The Pakistanis say the Kashmiri rebels are freedom fighters fighting for the independence of their land. The Indians say that the rebels in Kashmir are terrorists because they're trying to destroy a sovereign country. So I think it's important to talk about what the definition of terrorism is, and sometimes it's important for legal purposes, but I wouldn't get too hung up about debating it forever and ever, or else we'll have analysis paralysis by analysis if we're not careful.
Yeah, but when it's interesting to talk about it and think about it a little bit, because when it comes to defanging terrorism or getting at its root causes, mm-hmm. It's important to look at what it is and what it isn't and why it happens and who profits.
Exactly,
and
right.
That's one thing that we haven't talked about really today, and we're running out of time very quickly here. In fact, we're going to have to wrap it up. But economic greed is very definitely a factor here. And as I was reading your book last night, I was thinking that some of this organized crime connection with terrorism makes the Sopranos look like, you know, pickpockets.
You're exactly right, Celeste. I think there's a much more economic greed involved in this than people usually give credit. Even if these, even the people who are fanatics on the religious side, at least presumably fanatics on the religious side, I convinced there's an economic dimension to that. It's not purely religious. There is, so the economic greed aspect, I think, is increasingly important. And the second aspect is the right to land. Whose land is it?
Hmm.
And so I think that is a tremendously important factor, obviously, in the Israeli-Palestinian context, but in lots of other places, it's the right to land that is a key factor.
Hmm. Thank you very much for visiting with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste, for having me.
Glenn Schweitzer has been our guest. He's with the National Academy of Sciences. He's co-author with Carol Dorch Schweitzer of the book A Faceless Enemy, The Origins of Modern Terrorism. The book is published by Perseus Publishing.